Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here. Thanks for listening in this week, friends. I do appreciate it. As always, have a great show coming up for you. We're going to be chatting with celebrity chef Elizabeth Faulkner. And she is aside from being a celebrity chef, you may have seen her on TV, she's a passionate advocate for reducing food waste in restaurants and also able to give you some tips about how you might go about doing that at home. That'll be our featured interview. We'll get to that in just a bit. But first off, we're going to kick it right to my friend Evan Weiss, who is the organizer of the Bloody Mary Festival, which happens all over the country. And we're lucky enough to have the third iteration, if I'm not mistaken, taking place on November 2nd and 3rd here in New Orleans. Evan, how are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, man. We're excited to have you back here in town. And we were talking about some things right here before we went on the air. The event's coming up here November 2nd and 3rd in New Orleans, and we'll get to that in a second. But we're talking about growth, both with this show, but also with you guys. You're doing these festivals all over the country now, aren't you?
Yeah, we're in 10 different cities around the country. And, of course, it's a lot of the great foodie and cocktail cities that you would expect. We're in, of course, New Orleans, Austin, Texas, Nashville, Atlanta, New York, the Twin Cities, Milwaukee, which is absolutely bonkers, San Francisco, Portland, Oregon, Denver. So yeah, we're getting around.
That's really exciting, man. And this is the third year that you've done it here in New Orleans, correct? Or will be?
Yeah, this will be the third year, and the New Orleans Festival is one of our favorites. I mean, the crowd is amazing. The Bloody Marys are great. And like they say, let the good times roll.
There you go, man. Right on. Well, we love having you here. Tell us, Evan, a little bit about how a festival works. It's 2 days here in New Orleans, but how people can come. Local bars are making Bloody Marys. Give us the rundown of sort of the run of show.
Sure. So our group of Bloody Mary experts tasted a of Bloody Marys in New Orleans, and we asked our followers on social media to tell us what their favorite Bloody Marys are in New Orleans. We tasted them all, invited a bunch of them, and what we have happening on November 2nd and 3rd is our curated selection of the best Bloody Marys in the Big Easy. And what we look for is bars and restaurants using like creative recipes or innovative ingredients. You know, a room full of like traditional Bloody Marys would be kind of boring. So we found what we think are really some of the most creative. And of course, there's some traditional Bloody Marys in New Orleans. So we have about 15 of them over 2 days, and a ticket to the event gets you unlimited drinks of these Bloody Marys. Mm-hmm. And each attendee gets a vote for their favorite, and the bar or restaurant with the most votes will be crowned the People's Choice winner for the best Bloody Mary in New Orleans. And in addition to that voting, there'll be some expert judges walking around tasting and scoring the Bloody Marys. And they will also crown a judge's pick for the best Bloody Mary in New Orleans.
Now, right. And I appreciate using the term expert. We're going to use that term loosely because you asked me to be one of the judges, which I'm honored and thrilled to do. So it'll be a bunch of experts and me. So that
that's right. We went straight to the top.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate that. But really looking forward to it and appreciate you asking me to do it again. So it's a really fun event, as you mentioned. So a lot of the local bars and restaurants will come. They'll make their best Bloody Mary. Folks can come, they can buy a ticket, and then they can go taste them all, and then they get to vote for a People's Choice. And as you just said, Evan, there'll be a judge's choice too. But then there's some bites of food, and there's live entertainment. And this is kind of the run for all the festivals. Basically works the same way, right?
Yeah, that's right. So it's really evolved. It started out as kind of like a big Bloody Mary contest, but the event has really evolved into a brunch festival. So you know, the Bloody Marys are just a small portion of what you'll be able to enjoy. Like you said, there'll be food samples and local food companies sampling their products and local beverage companies sampling their products. So it's really evolved into like a brunch festival.
Yeah, especially when you consider what some of the people, the ornate garnishes that they use, that they put in the Bloody Marys. I come hungry and I leave satiated, both on the drink front and the food front, because I get a meal and half the glasses.
Oh, for sure. And all you have to do is check out our Instagram page at the Bloody Mary Fest and see some of the over-the-top garnishes that the participants are bringing.
Yeah. And it's a lot of fun. It's a great vibe. It's there at Howl and Wolf. We'll do this, Evan. We got about a minute left before got to take a commercial break here. Tell people where they can find the website, where they can buy tickets to this event and find out about events in other parts of the country and connect with you on social media as well, as you just said.
Sure. So the event is Saturday and Sunday, November 2nd and 3rd at the Howl and Wolf in New Orleans. There's still tickets available. The BloodyMaryFest.com. The event in New Orleans, I didn't even name any of the participants, but we'll have Ruby Slipper Cafe, who won Best Traditional Bloody Mary. They'll be back again this year. Oceana Grill, Roosevelt Hotel. Other events, we have Austin, Texas coming up November 17th. Like we said at the top of the show, we're in a bunch of cities. So if you love Bloody Marys, chances are we're coming to a city near you. So check out the website, thebloodymaryfest.com.
Yeah, perfect. So friends, go check out bloodymaryfest.com. If you're here in New Orleans, be sure to come check out the festival Saturday, November 2nd, Sunday, November 3rd at the Howl and Wolf, 907 South Peters Street. And you can come find me there and look for the idiot with the clipboard, and you can come harass me and give me some pointers, because I can use that too. Evan, looking forward to seeing you, man, and good luck getting everything organized. I know it's going to happen swimmingly, and we're going to have a great festival here in a couple weeks or so.
Thanks, Brian. See you soon.
My pleasure. Hey, friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, and then we're going to be back with Chef Elizabeth Faulkner.
Every afternoon when I wake up, I say a little prayer and drink up and thank the Lord for driving me home. Goodbye, Joe. I got to go. Me, oh, my, oh. I got to go. Pull a P-Roll down to bio. My boss is a sweet.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Hey, thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. I do appreciate it as always. And as you know, it's another installment here of our sustainability series. And we've got a great topic and a great guest lined up for you here today, which I've already run down for you at the beginning of the show. You know that, Elizabeth Faulkner. Chef Faulkner, how are you?
I am good. How are you?
It's great. Thanks for making time. It's great to meet you in person.
Same here. It's nice to be here, Brian.
Absolutely. Thanks. Welcome to New Orleans. I should say that. Not that I'm like duly appointed ambassador to anything, but.
You know, I always just feel so welcome in New Orleans. It's just one of those amazing food towns that has hospitality nailed.
Yeah, we do that pretty well here for the most part. Not all the time, but most of the time. And you're here in town, Elizabeth, because you're giving a talk this evening. Listeners are going to hear this a little bit down the road, but giving a talk at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, part of the National Food and Beverage Foundation, and talking about reducing restaurant waste. And that's kind of our topic for the day. But for folks out there who aren't familiar with you, can tell us,
tell
us a little bit about yourself, please.
Yeah, I'm originally from California. I grew up in the Los Angeles area, lived in San Francisco for 25 years, and started cooking after college there. Worked in some great restaurants, opened up Citizen Cake in 1997, had another couple restaurants in between while I was still running that for 15 years, and still love the Bay Area, but I moved to New York 7 years ago, opened a couple of other restaurants for other people, and then about 4 years ago, I was like, okay, I need a little time out from restaurants, and I've ended up doing so much more work around food that isn't about me managing a restaurant, which is, you know, it was kind of hard because it was my identity for so long. But then I've also learned that there's just a lot to do in food that's outside of restaurants.
Absolutely. Without a doubt. Let me ask you, so just kind of back to your cooking career. So you come from a bit more of a pastry background. Is that right?
It's mixed, because when I first started cooking, I worked in a little French bistro, ran that kitchen for just over a year, started staging in fine dining restaurants in the early 90s. And then I got put in the pastry department at a restaurant called Masa's under Julian Serrano. And then about a year later, I ended up getting a job as the pastry chef for Tracy Desjardins in when she was a chef de cuisine at a restaurant called Elka in Japantown in San Francisco. And then I just started getting so much attention for dessert making, even though I had always had ambitions to be on the savory side as well. But then I also kind of really love the food science and the playfulness around pastry. So it just was something that I just kind of was like, well, somebody has to be the spokesperson for the pastry people. And then also
they need it too.
I'm like hyper creative. So I just kind of already was turning things upside down and coming up with some wild dessert titles and ways to make things and really think about dessert differently. And I just got a lot of attention for it. So then when I opened up Citizen Cake, it was a bakery, pastry shop, and then a cafe. And then we moved it and it became a full restaurant. So I've always kind of had my hands in both and the management side of it. And then, but by the time I started doing food television, because I've done a lot of those cooking shows, I always did savory stuff too. And people still, I would say the networks kept, stereotype me as a pastry chef.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, because they would always just say, hey, here's your one name title. You're a great pastry chef. And I'm like, hey, but I like to cook everything.
Everything, fair enough. And now I feel bad because I fell into that trap and asked you that question. Okay. So sorry about that. Didn't mean to put you in a box. But that's I'm always curious because I like people that come from a pastry background. And because it is so sort of specific in a way.
Yeah.
And I always want to know what motivates people to get into it there. But so let's talk about that too. What attracted you to doing the TV stuff?
Well, to be honest with you, like, so, let's see, in the early 2000s, the Food Network really started airing in the Bay Area. And, so I was so super excited about it, and I wanted to, I've started watching some shows, and I wanted to participate on some level. And probably, I think around 2001 or two, I got asked to do one of those Food Network Challenge shows. And, It was kind of funny because like the first one they did was Cereal Skyline, and I had helped a pastry chef before compete for the Coupe du Monde, the World Cup team of pastry, and found it to be way too rigid and old fashioned. So when the network came around and said, "Hey, we have this competition, and you have to make a skyline out of cereal treats," and I was like, "Oh my God, how cool!" And they thought I was going to do San Francisco, and I said, "No, I'm really interested in the gentrification of the Lower East Side of Manhattan. I'd like to do that." And so they're like, "All right." And then the next one that came along was supposed to be Haunted Gingerbread. And I said, as long as it's Haunted Gingerbread, but not a gingerbread house. Because if it's a caricature of a house, I'm not doing it. And
just because it's sort of cliche?
So,
or is it,
just again, the stereotypical stuff.
Sure,
I was like,
sure,
no, I'm
okay.
going to make a Frank Gehry cave that you can stick your face up to and be really scared of and stick your hands into, like a real haunted house. And, you know, just did some crazy stuff with it. It was a blast. But I think that they were like, well, she's a wild card. We don't know what to do with this kind of personality on television, right? So then Bravo started, and somebody came and asked me to be a judge on the first season of Top Chef. And that was a dessert challenge. And then I did the first season of Top Chef Masters. So the whole genre of sort of these cooking competition shows happened while I was already running restaurants and kind of at the top of that game.
And did you enjoy doing the television stuff?
I love all that stuff. I've also been a really athletic chef or a sporty chef, and so I played soccer until I was 38, even while working in these restaurants and just making time for it. And usually my chefs, I mean, like when I worked for other chefs, they liked the fact that Julian loved that I played soccer. So anyway, this cooking competitions were like sport and cooking met, and I was like, this is great because I really like practicing drills and kind of being amped up for it. And I started studying Korean sword fighting. So I found martial arts, the combination of, you know, the hyper athletic sport stuff and cooking together was just sort of like everything that food competition is.
Yeah. Very cool. Interesting. I'm also always very curious about how that works because everybody sees, you know, you see a half an hour,
right?
But I know these things are often, you know, a whole day or days long and weeks long to kind of truncate everything together, and then how the editing works and things like that. It's always,
right.
It tells you maybe a bit of a different story than what you actually lived.
Well, it's true. Yeah. I mean, they're also creating entertainment. So,
right. Exactly. Well, so you're giving a talk today, as we mentioned, at the museum, and talking about reducing restaurant food waste, which is a very, very important topic. What kind of, what inspired you to get into that as a cause?
Well, I would say anybody who runs a restaurant is hopefully especially this day and age, aware of how much food waste there is just in restaurants. And the truth is, it's for anybody, consumer or a restaurant owner, it's just throwing money away. Like,
right.
I think people just, chefs can, like anybody, can get lazy and overorder. I think it starts with overordering things and then just not using them fast enough or feeling like you have to have everything on hand. I mean, like, you see a lot more restaurants today, like, actually running out of a dish, and that, and it's actually more acceptable today, too. But for a good chunk of time, it was sort of like, what do you mean you're out of that dish? Like, you can't, we want everything available all the time. And I think our whole mindset in purchasing, whether it's for home or for the restaurant, and as a consumer going to restaurants and as a chef, is to, like, let's just use what we have and let's get really creative with what we have on hand and make up some new stuff. I mean, the point of all of this to me is a good challenge. It offers us this moment to be, like, more creative with food, with ingredients.
Right. This is kind of a tangent because we'll get into some other things, but I'm assuming that the trend towards a seasonality and farm to table actually can work really well with this, right?
Oh, I think so. I think that, you know, it's funny. When I opened a restaurant in New York a few years ago, one of my sous chefs was like, "Hey, Elizabeth, it's asparagus season in New York. It's January." And I was like, "It's, first of all, it's never asparagus season in January."
No matter where.
And I'm like, no, the asparagus is coming from another country. And sure, I know that we all want some asparagus by the time January comes around because it seems like so long since we had those vegetables.
Right.
Or something green. Or we're anticipating spring already. But in fact, it's not. That's, we can be more clever than that and not just sort of give in to, like, oh, that sounds really good right now and I can get some and it's pretty cheap.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, really paying attention to the seasons. And also the thing is, like, in a place like New York, well, and here too, people, actually New Orleans has a great history of preserving and pickling and stuff like that.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think people, like, somehow in the last probably 40, 50 years, we've gotten further and further away from this idea of preserving things ourselves and making our own recipes and canning and all the things that my grandparents used to do. And, and that's a shame because there's just, first of all, it's really good for you to take whatever's in season, buy it at its cheapest, you know, put it in a jam or a pickle or kimchi or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, chefs are doing it. Chefs are doing a lot more fermentation these days.
Absolutely.
So yeah. I'm kind of hoping that that keeps moving into the public as well.
Yeah, that's great. You made me think of this because you used the term thinking that you always have to have everything on hand. And I mean, that's a really interesting way to put it, because there is that idea that your menu is kind of static and then you have to have X ingredients to execute your menu. But, you know, when you go seasonal, obviously, or you go sort of farm to table, it's, you have what you're going to use. And it's at that time of year for all the reasons that you just said.
Yeah. And also, like, I think sometimes in restaurants we get sort of like, oh, we have to keep offering this dish because that's what the people keep buying.
Right.
And the truth is, I think people will buy, if you make something really tasty, people are going to buy it. So if you say, hey, we're out of arugula right now, but we're going to move into collard green salad, just like kale, but it's collard greens instead. I know we only usually have it, you know, braised, but, like, it's actually really good raw. It's a hearty green.
Mm-hmm.
Goes to, with some really, you know, pungent and fiery
kinda
things.
Spicy, yeah,
kinda
absolutely,
great.
Yeah.
So I think it's more a matter of just, again, coming back to creativity and utilizing this amazing gift we have, which is being creative with things.
Right. Absolutely. Well, Elizabeth, let's do this. Let's take a little break.
Okay.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about reducing food waste, why it's important economically, both for the bottom line of a restaurant, why it's good for you to do this at home. And then I think we'll probably get into some things that you can actually do to execute reducing food waste. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show, Brian D'Asia. Thanks for listening in. We are chatting with Chef Elizabeth Faulkner. We're talking about reducing food waste, kind of from a restaurant angle, but just also in general. And I was looking at some numbers. Some of this, Elizabeth, I was aware of. The one that I was aware of is about one-third of all food is on the planet is thrown away or goes to waste.
At least one-third.
Yeah.
It's really around 40%.
Is it that high? Okay.
And there are initiatives to bring those numbers down, but still a super high amount. The problem is it actually starts at the farm because we're actually, especially in this country, overproducing so much. We're growing too much, producing too much, and just that it's not before it even gets to the consumer, we've already thrown away a good chunk of it.
Right. And let's elaborate on that a little bit too, because is this just it's sort of wasted byproduct, but then also isn't it something too where we're taking the sweet spots, if you will, of bits of produce, right, and we're discarding the greens, for example, and things like that. Is that also
so many pieces like that? And also just like we grow way more corn than we need.
Okay.
I mean, we grow corn for, you know, for the gas from
it,
ethanol. Mm-hmm. And then and we're also just growing so much more corn than we need, and it's going to animal feed in worst possible ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then and then we also have this problem of, so there's the food waste there, but it's also adding to climate change because you can say that it's about farming and livestock, and that's the main culprit, and that is one of the main culprits. But it's also just the fact that we're doing this much agricultural production, shipping it to places, so that the mm-hmm. emissions from the transportation mm-hmm. is another layer, and then.
Well, and petrochemical use on the farm too, right? And just things like that as well. When we're using very intense fertilizer, very intense pesticide use, and
so there's that. And then you think about all that stuff going into refrigeration over different distribution centers.
Right,
then it finally gets to wholesale or retail, which is also going under refrigeration. So the whole series before we even talk about it getting to the plate and being thrown in the garbage, or like making something and throwing half of it away. It's that the whole entire system is broken. So it's all really contributing a lot to climate change and also just this food waste factor.
Okay, and just inefficiencies from start to finish.
Yeah.
And I was in this particular report that I was citing that about, you know, they estimated one third, as I said, of all food is thrown away, and they estimated a $940 billion economic cost per year, and then kind of contrasted that with 800,000 people, which to me was a low number, are undernourished on the
planet.
Right. I think it's much higher than 800,000, but that's their conservative estimate.
Right. So something's really wrong in the distribution of food stuff in general. The way we've sort of done, I think this all really started just at the Second World War. So you think about like America after the First World War and the Great Depression after the stock market crash in 1929. People were coming from a place of not having so much. And I actually was just in China recently, and seeing the growth and the economic boom in China is fantastic on some level, but it's also kind of terrifying because you see a lot of the systems that we do kind of happening over there. And I just think, you know, people just started, there was also just a lot of propaganda at the time, too, about Americans sort of having this right to overconsume.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this concept of, like, it's our right to have big plates of stuff and more than we need, and it's overabundance because that's what America is actually done such a disservice to us for the next 50 years of, you know, where we went in big agriculture and big farming and just a lot of marketing. I think that the marketing spin on what is nutritious and how some of those things are so, it's just misinformation.
Right.
Out
with processed foods, and then talking about what we were talking about in the previous segment about always having to have things on hand, right? So what we're shipping is, we were noting, say, obviously very typical, a lot of produce that comes from South America during certain times of year to just keep those shelves stocked. And then we talk about the amount of waste, the amount just any single grocery store throws away in a day is astounding.
Plus we just have these supermarkets with so much inventory.
Right, exactly.
And you know, they have all these, there's also this, we have no regulation in every state and in cities about expiration dates. So this is like a massive problem because you could go from one state to the other and the milk will have a just a different idea, a different somebody randomly just decided the expiration date's going to be, you know, 10 days after it's been produced.
Mm-hmm.
And even though people just forget that, like, why don't you smell the product? You can smell when something's good or bad. So people just think, oh my God, the expiration date of this yogurt is bad. I have to throw it out. I know a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm like, that's not true, because this thing is alive and you can smell it. And if it's like got blue mold all over it, yeah, it's gone bad.
Generally, there you go. Use your nose and use your eyes. Absolutely. And the smell, there's a reason why we have that sense of smell, right?
But also, like, don't buy that much yogurt if you're not going to eat it.
There's,
you know,
also that. And yogurt does keep for a while. So yeah, if you're buying that much and it's going bad, then, well, that's a lot of yogurt. Well, we were talking about this during the break, Elizabeth, because I mentioned to you that I lived in Korea for a year, and I also lived in other parts of the developing world. And that actually taught me a lot about food consumption, because people are so concerned about spoilage and about waste in ways that are not necessary. So you would go to an outdoor market in Korea, and it's pretty warm outside. The meat's just out. And other English teachers, gringos that I was working with, they're like, I'm not buying that. And I'm like, well, everybody else is eating it, and they all live and seem happy.
Yeah, so they've been doing that for a long time.
They've been doing that for a long time. I'm going in.
Yeah.
Well, so we were talking about, you know, sort of on a global level about food production stuff and cost and things. And it was curious, too, because I came across another report that was talking about restaurants specifically, and the estimates, which also seemed kind of low to me, they gave was something like, what do I have here? About 9.55% of in fast food restaurants, the food is wasted. Mm. And in full service restaurants, 11.3%.
Yeah.
Which is obviously much lower than the global production, but that's still a pretty sizable number.
Well, the other thing is, like, you know, in restaurant world, the margins are so small. So
right,
if you only have like a, maybe if you're lucky, you have a 5 to 6% margin of, you know.
And that's on the high end.
Yeah, that's
right?
The high end. I mean, you're lucky if you're hitting that. And I've been there. And so you have to get really smart about using every single piece of everything. I remember one time in my bakery, and in a bakery you have to as well, because you're buying like butter and chocolate and things that, you know, even when you temper chocolate, when you make things with chocolate, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Obviously, you never throw away the trimmings of the chocolate that you're making little decorations from. You keep reusing it, meaning you're going to turn it into another chocolate decoration.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's such an expensive product, and why would you just throw away that? And think about, like, bread pudding or, like, an almond croissant. Those are creative periods of time when people thought, oh, I've got all this extra bread, and let's just add some custard to it and bake it, and it becomes this amazing, delicious dessert. Same with an almond croissant. You take day-old croissants, you put almond paste in between, bake it again. Now you have a new product out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just critical that cooks are really think about the energy that goes into growing everything. And, you know, there's nothing that's not that. I mean, it's just this rethinking about the value of energy in things. I don't know if you ever saw this PSA that came out probably about 5 years ago called The Life and Times of a Strawberry.
I don't think
so. It was a great little short video. It's about a minute long, I think. And it goes from where the strawberry is growing in a field. I mean, you really feel the strawberry. So the strawberry is sitting in the field, and the farmer comes by and picks it out of the ground. And look, and like it's grown. It's gone from white to red in, you know, a few seconds. And it's got like a little green top, like a little hairdo blowing in the wind, right? And so the farmer puts it in a box. The strawberry seems to be kind of like, I don't know, you just have, like, all of a sudden the strawberry has emotions and you're, like, totally identifying with the strawberry. And then it gets in a, you know, in a crate with other strawberries. It goes on a conveyor belt. It goes on trucks. It goes across the country. Goes on a jet. It's like living the dream. And then ends up in the grocery store, and it's like, oh, I'm finally in my place. And a little girl comes by and says, Mom, can we get some strawberries? And she's like, well, you never eat the whole carton. So she's like, please. And so the mom ends up putting it in the basket. They take it home. Like, the strawberry's like been around the world, right? Yeah. And then it goes, they open up the refrigerator, put it in there, and then it's dark. And it's dark for a while. And they come in every once in a while and get other things out of the refrigerator. It's still sitting there. And then it starts to get kind of sad because it's really dying in there, right? And then the mom comes in, like, what seems like so much time has passed, picks up the strawberry package and puts it in the garbage.
Oh, wow.
And okay, you're like, oh my God.
No. Elizabeth, let's do this. Let's take a little break on that tragic note of the strawberry. We're going to take a little break on the No Drink Show. Come on back.
I was born by the river in a little tent, yeah.
Now, if you ever been down to New Orleans, then you can understand just what I mean. Now, all through the week, it's quiet as a mouse.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. I do appreciate it. As always, we're chatting with Chef Elizabeth Faulkner. We're talking about reducing food waste. And Elizabeth is sticking around for another shot with Noah Drinks, our podcast-only portion, and we'll talk a little bit more about restaurant stuff specifically then. But what are some things, Elizabeth, that people could just sensible, easy things that one can do to reduce waste? We all, I think a lot of us, everybody out there is not going to, don't lie to us, we all know that you throw stuff away and you go, man, I should have used that.
Yeah, I mean, I think personally taking an inventory is a good idea. Just looking in the pantry and the refrigerator at what you have on hand before you actually go out and go shopping. And listen, like, I love going to the green market at different times of the year. Yeah, and yeah. For me, that's like, I want to go on a shopping spree because I'm looking at, you know, I take my dog and I'm looking at radishes and I'm looking at, you know, the rainbow chards and I'm looking at all this stuff. First, thank God I only have a small refrigerator in Brooklyn, New York, because I can only fit so much. Right. And since I always am making lots of like little sauces and things, I just have a lot of stuff around because I cook all the time. And but I think you still have to kind of really like look at yourself and say, what do I need to use up before it does go bad? I think that's sort of the key, is like not overbuying and then looking in the freezer, looking in the pantry and looking in the fridge of what you have and what can you creatively come up with. And I think a fun game to play with your family and friends is something that another chef friend of mine, Ed Brown, calls like the refrigerator challenge. So it's basically creating like a cooking competition arena idea, like a chopped basket, basically.
Okay.
But using, you know, some ingredients from the refrigerator that maybe don't necessarily belong together, but could you come up with something? Because honestly, that's what we have to do on those shows. And,
right,
and in some way, I mean, I think those shows have actually helped me really just sort of give myself permission to go, I can use this and this and this and come up with something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fun challenge to see what you can do. And I feel like since everybody loves those shows, why not?
Mm-hmm.
And I know kids like to do that. You give them a challenge, and the kids who like to cook, it's great.
Yeah.
And if kids don't like to cook, I mean, that's a genuine concern of mine. I think people around the world need to kind of come back to this idea of how important it is to teach kids about how to grow things and how to cook things. So that's just a fun way to sort of introduce the idea of cooking to a kid. Mm-hmm. Say, let's just make it a game. And then, let's say you just have some extra food scraps. Another really cool idea that I heard recently and thought it was really funny, and I was emceeing this Food Waste Day in New York, and I did it on stage, is taking some, like I had some extra blueberries in my freezer, and I had a little knob of ginger, and I took some sesame seeds, mixed it up with some yogurt and some pineapple, and basically made myself a face mask. Because, you know, you buy all these cosmetics and face mask stuff to keep your skin looking good. And the truth is all those ingredients come from fruits and vegetables,
right,
plants.
Right.
And to be honest with you, I put this little purple mask on my face while I was on stage. It was kind of cool and refreshing, really nice. And then I wiped it off afterwards. And then I was like, you know, actually my skin does feel really good.
Right.
I was like, I'm going to do this more often. Like, why not? And I had this whole like fantasy of like life living in New York where we have these big apartment buildings. And if we could all just bring all of our little scraps together and have like face mask party and smoothie party on Saturday,
yeah, absolutely,
with brunch, you know,
yeah, yeah,
and then, you know, besides like getting all of the systems in all these different cities together of better waste management and composting and stuff, we don't have that together in New York. It's not a cohesive concept, which is shameful. There's too many people living there to not think of some way to do this. But anyway, I think that's a cool idea. You know, just come up with something playful. And I was like, gosh, I wonder if I could make like a whole bath of fruit and vegetable stuff. But then I was like, that probably won't go down the drain very well.
Yeah, right. There's that. You know, one of the things that I do, Elizabeth, too, and I think because in this day and age with the internet and our ability to use search engines and things like that, as my wife will attest to, I cannot bake because I can't stay that tightly to a script. So I just kind of, I'm more of what's in the pantry, and then I come up with something. But, you know, if there's some stuff laying around, I'll just get online and type recipes and put like one ingredient or two ingredients that I have laying around and just see what pops up. And then even if just use it to seek inspiration, even if you don't follow that recipe.
Well, that's totally true. And to be honest with you, that's what most chefs do. We just are thinking, oh, here, it's like I got a surplus of okra, let's say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like certain things might come pop into your head of what you like or what you've had or what you like to cook with okra. But then if you just type in the word okra, you'll all of a sudden have all these other inspirations of different recipes, right, and think, oh, I should try that, or, oh, I can make a combo. And soon enough, you'll come up with your own recipe, basically.
Right.
I like that.
I think that's great. And that also allows you to, I think, when you have, say you made a main dish and you have some leftover portions of things, ingredients that you've used, you know, figuring out ways to use those in a side dish or do something, like you said, preserve stuff, or, you know, eat it tomorrow in a completely different meal. There's always ways to repurpose.
Look
stuff.
It up in a different country, like okra from India.
Yeah.
So many dishes, so many amazing with okra that, you know, since we're in New Orleans and talking about okra,
I mean, that would be
really different kind of way of cooking it than, mm-hmm, than people do typically here.
And yes, and then we're repurposing a similar and certainly what happens around here is we can end up with lots of okra. So
repurposing
okra in different ways is people will offer you, do you want any okra? It's like, no, I'm already swimming in okra. You sure? I got a lot of extra okra. Well, cool. So you're going to stick around for another shot with Nola Drinks, and we're going to talk a little bit more, as I said, about restaurant stuff. I did like what you said about the kids, because I think part of the purpose here and what the point we were getting at is if you teach kids to cook and you teach them that thing, that there's more respect is then created for the process of where food comes from. It doesn't just come from a plastic bag or the McDonald's drive-through. I think that's a really important thing, and I think you're right. We've sort of lost touch with that in teaching kids that.
I think we lost touch
as individuals. Period.
Right. I think we lost touch for a while, but the good news is that because more and more smaller farmers markets are opening around the country, and chefs are using much more local seasonal ingredients. I've seen that a lot. I've seen this transformation in the last 20 years. That is. Especially the last 10 years, where I can go to a lot of different smaller towns or cities across the United States and see people doing really interesting things with their local ingredients. So I think that because that's happening, I hope that helps influence the consumers at home and kids too, mm-hmm, because, I mean, honestly, just in China too, I met this woman in Chengdu who was teaching families and kids how to cook and set the table and really be part of a family and how important food is very important to Chinese culture. But to see this similar thing going on where people just order a lot of takeout, you know, the technology is great because people can now have more immediate gratification by just pretty much ordering food wherever they are. And that happens all over the world. But that's also like scary because people think that, seriously, some people really think that like some food comes from just the freezer department or a jar.
Right, right, exactly.
And they don't even have any concept that macaroni and cheese is something you can make macaroni by hand.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Right. Good point. Eat seasonal, friends. Take a list. Take an inventory. Repurpose. There's some really great points that we've given you here today. We are going to sign the portion of the radio show up. Before we do that, Elizabeth, tell people where they can find you online and all that good stuff.
Oh, you can look me up on my website at elizabethfalkner.com. It's F-A-L-K-N-E-R, no you. And then I also am on Instagram and Twitter at Chef, whatever that and sign is.
At sign, yes.
Yeah, okay. Chef Faulkner. And then Facebook, I have a fan page, Chef Elizabeth Faulkner.
Awesome. You're going to stick around for another shot with Nola Drinks, but friends, if you're listening on the radio, go get the podcast, because this conversation is going to continue to be interesting, and that's where a lot of the good stuff is going to be. But if you are listening on the radio, I appreciate that too, friends. And remember, kind to one another, use your turn signal. And until next time, cheers, y'all.
then he said, all these saints and all these sinners will try to bend your.
All right, everybody. Yep, another Shot with Noel Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for sticking around with us, friends, this week. Hope you are enjoying our conversation with Chef Elizabeth Faulkner. We're going to bounce right back over to that conversation and chat a little bit more about reducing waste in restaurant spaces. And, you know, some of these implications also might relate to you if you're not in a restaurant space. But important stuff overall. Here we go. Yep, another Shot with Noel Drinks, friends. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the show this week. As always, part of our sustainability series, and a real pleasure here to chat with Chef Elizabeth Faulkner. We're talking about reducing food waste in the last segment there. We told you kind of maybe more what you can do as a consumer at home about certain ways that you can stop wasting so much food and fun ways to repurpose the food, which I think is a great idea. We're talking a little bit maybe more, Elizabeth, this time around about restaurant stuff. And we I noted at the beginning that, you know, one study was talking about full service restaurants. Study was about 11.5% is wasted. Another thing that I read, which I find very interesting, they had a group of restaurants. I think it was 114 restaurants over 12 countries. Big restaurants, small mom-and-pop restaurants, so we, you know, cut across country lines, different scales of restaurants. And they did a whole thing where they had people get on a food reduction program and codify their program. And they found in the study for every dollar spent on the program, they saved $7. Mm. Which I think is—so there's a—where I'm going with this is there's a clear economic incentive if you're running a restaurant. We talked about margins. And we were talking about like 5 or 6% on the high end, 3% is kind of often often the norm, even if you're lucky. And so this is the second highest cost for restaurants in most cases, right after personnel, is the cost of food production or the food that you purchase for prep. So where I'm, as I just said, there's a real economic reason to do this, right? I mean, this is going to help your single digit margin.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's kind of still shocking to me that. A lot of places, because I cook all over the, I just do events all over the place these days, mm-hmm. And I'll show up, you know, it's not like I'm traveling with a team and everybody knows exactly what I want out of something, but if I say, can you prep the carrots for me, it's kind of surprising to me that even today that people will still peel carrots, first of all, because there's really nothing wrong with the outside of the carrot as long as you wash it.
I love it.
And then, and actually, I know I love the way it looks too, and I feel like, oh my God, what era are you living in? When... I haven't peeled a carrot and I mean, I peel parsnips because they're kind of funky on the outside.
Ginger, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. but some people would tell you don't really have to do that, peeling ginger. But I think it just keeps coming back to really having a deeper respect for the other things that grow on the planet and utilizing all of the energy that went into the whole thing. So when we talk about like nose to tail or seed to flower or root to stem or root to leaf kind of cooking, I think in restaurants, and a lot of restaurants are working really hard at doing this, but if you're not thinking like nose to tail or the whole utilizing every single piece of everything, one, it's just throwing money away. And two, it's like you're missing an opportunity to be really creative or get your teams or staff really excited about being creative with ingredients. If you say, again, it kind of goes back to that refrigerator challenge concept, like,
right,
here's what we have today. Because let's think about it for a second. If you go back historically, people have made amazing, iconic dishes out of nothing sometimes. I mean, you know, there's a pasta in Italy that comes from the burnt fields of wheat. So that, and that still gets utilized and turned into another pasta. I think about things like another pasta dish when you think about cacio e pepe. Well, cheese isn't inexpensive, but that dish is only made with pasta, cheese, and pepper. That's cacio and pepper, mm-hmm. and pepper. So, and you think about some of the more simple dishes around the world or just areas where something has become super iconic. It's because they used what they had. It's not like they just thought, oh, what do I feel like cooking today? It's sort of like, this is what we have. So we're going to use it and come up with clever ways to use it.
Right.
And I feel like that's the sort of the main opportunity we have in restaurants is to say, look, that's great that you can cook that dish. Everybody can make that dish, but what else can you do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how can you still get some of those flavors but turn it into something different?
Right. Okay. One of the things that I've seen more and more lately, and I think is great, is the bar program working with the kitchen. And I think that that opens up all kinds of avenues. This is why we're seeing more beet cocktails on the menu, which I'm a big fan of. But that's a it's a good way. I see some of the more creative chefs and bar directors here in town and elsewhere. They're integrating their program more about having, because I think people might say, well, that's kind of obvious, right? You're all going to order what you're going to order for the restaurant or the bar, and everybody knows. That conversation is not necessarily traditional to have in a restaurant, right? Where the whole team sits down and says, well, this is what I'm thinking about bringing in seasonal to the kitchen, and the bar director can be like, ah, I can do this drink or things like that. And it seems so obvious, but it's really not done that often.
I think so too. I think his, there were some part of time in restaurants where the bar orders their stuff, keep it separate from the restaurant. You know, it's like the enemy or something, like two different teams,
yeah,
not even
right,
playing,
right.
Which doesn't make any sense. You're all working under the same roof. And this idea that like those are my lemons and those are your lemons. And like, I'm sorry, but why can't we use all the lemon skins and all of the, you know, juice inside and think of other ways that we can infuse even just the pithy rind stuff in something else.
Right.
But that's what we're seeing a lot more today. I think bartenders are just, and mixologists are doing great things with sharing some of that produce and herbs and stuff.
And it's just, it's also just sensible. I mean, we are talking about a certain sensible level of economics. It reminds me, Elizabeth, when I was working with some wine grape growers in Lake County, which you're familiar with, north of Napa there in California, and there was this sustainability program that was being put in. A lot of really good stuff. I'll spare y'all. We've talked about it at other times. But, you know, a lot of what we're talking about was sustainable grape growing, like some of these old dirt farmers that started out, their families were growing walnuts and pears, and then now are growing grapes. They were like, we just call this sensible farming, you know, limiting inputs and things like that because it's just good economics and it's sensible farming. And I think that sort of concept of bringing that into the restaurant, we're seeing a little bit of that more where it is – it's just sensible on a production level. It's sensible on an economic level. It's sensible on a team level. It doesn't need to be foreign thinking.
Yeah, it's funny because you just made me think, too, about the chefs who have been able to sort of grow farms and use, which is great, but it seems like such a privileged thing. But in the old days, that's quite normal. You have the farm, and then maybe somebody cooks, and everybody eats there all the time, or they have a restaurant, and it happens to be... Like, I've been to some... I feel like I'm talking about Italy a lot, but I've been to Italy a lot.
Fair enough.
And some of the best food I've had is... They'll say, oh, we have, you know, this polenta that's milled right here, because that corn grows right here, and we put a fresh chicken egg yolk on top, and I hear the rooster outside crowing, and or hear him kind of shuffling around, and then we have Parmigiano Reggiano and truffles in season. And you're like, oh my god, yes, that sounds amazing. And also, like, everything did just grow right here. Like, mm-hmm. The reason why we're having this is because it's just right here.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, this is the best thing I've ever had. I wish I could make this at home, but then you need to live near a place that makes Parmigiano Reggiano, has truffles.
right.
And grows exactly. That specific kind of
about
corn.
About the only one you can probably have is the chickens. Right. That one you can probably do anywhere if you're willing to, you know, have chickens.
But do you know what I mean?
So yeah, absolutely.
That's a pretty picture of northern Italian food. But we have those kind of places all around the country. And if the more people that grow little gardens and farms and utilize that in their cooking, I mean, you know, Alice Waters has been talking about this for a long time. But when kids get their hands on, you know, stuff that they're, the tomatoes and the beans and the peppers and the eggplants that they're growing in the garden. I mean, they have such an appreciation for this, the way they've seen it grow up.
Absolutely.
And then they get to make a salad and they get to make pizza and, you know, and then it's like, those are creating great memories. And really, food is about storytelling and nostalgia. And so if you can create at any point in somebody's life this story that's so beautiful because everything actually is from there and it tastes so much better, it changes their story in their head, and all of a sudden they're like, I didn't like eggplant, but now I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it really does.
It absolutely changes. I know there's all kinds of things I didn't like when I was a kid and when we started growing them in the family garden. It's amazing how your tastes change when you're out there because it's your job to water and weed.
Right.
Like, damn it, I'm eating it.
It's so true. Like, I was just going to say one more thing. I didn't know I was privileged when I was younger, and we went to visit my grandparents who had a farm in Missouri. And they pretty much lived off the farm. And we would go fishing with my grandfather, and we would just catch like little crappie and perch, mm-hmm. tiny little fish. And my grandparents weren't great cooks; they just kind of ate what they had. But because I had green beans and tomatoes from the farm and watermelon out in the farm on a hot day, or because my grandfather would just dredge the fish in cornmeal and put a little black pepper on it and pan fry it in a cast iron skillet, still like to this date, I can say that is some of the best fish I've ever had, mm-hmm. because I remember how fresh and just like kind of perfect and simple it was,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I just, yeah, I could talk about food forever.
Yeah, oh, fair enough. Well, let me ask you this one set of questions here. In the restaurant setting, because when I was looking at some of this stuff, we're talking about that study about implementing a waste reduction program. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. What am I going to open up here and see? And like, what are the guidelines, or what are, you know, maybe some very technical stuff about how to do this, that, and the other thing. And the steps were almost painfully simple. Also, that you think were just sort of logical. One of the main ones was just properly training your staff on handling food.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, oh, okay, wow, that's not that hard, right?
No.
And I mean, what are some of those things that you can do, like say in that restaurant setting then, that, I mean, I know we've touched on some of this kitchen working with bar and things, taking an inventory seasonal, but just like simple, there's some simple steps that can be taken where you can save yourself a few dollars, right?
Yeah. Again, I think it's really just looking at the inventory when stuff comes in, that keeping it organized, storing things the way they're, the way they should be stored. And not just, I've been in those kitchens too where people just kind of throw all the herbs on one shelf, and then you're like, oh my God, but half of the dill is dead and half of the basil is dead, and you're like looking for it, and you're like, why is this here?
Mm-hmm.
And it's really just kind of common sense. Like, why would you just want to keep buying that stuff to have on hand so that people could cook, but they're not even using it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just throwing money away.
Right.
It's just comes down to the bottom line. You're just not going to have the margins that you want by just throwing food away. I think, sharing all of that information with the whole staff, the front and back of the house, is important, so everybody knows what's going in. The restaurants that are successful are doing all that, mm-hmm. already. And again, being creative with like the trimmings, the stems, the roots, the whatever in stocks, and really just coming up with new things. Like, I'm classically French trained. And I would say in France, it isn't that people, they don't just throw a bunch of stuff away. But the way we've sort of applied it to our cooking in the United States, not currently, but like, maybe over the last 30 years or more, I think there's just a lot of wastefulness in thinking you have to cut up everything in perfect little brunoise shape.
Okay.
And forget about the rest of it. But the truth is, if you go back in time, even if when French people started making up cute little shapes of turned vegetables and fruits and stuff, they still use the scraps for other purposes. So it's just being smart and not wasting, being creative and being smart.
Being creative and smart and writing your menus based around what you have and using up what you have. And
yeah, the other thing is, like, I talked a little bit about waste management. The other thing is, like, in San Francisco, that's a city that's been aggressively trying to change the waste management systems for a while. And I remember when I was still there, I remember the time where our garbage disposal company said, okay, you're going to have to separate all of your composting, all your garbage, and all your recycling, and all your fat, from the fryer kind of stuff. And so it was like, well, we don't even have all the space for all the bins and stuff, and how are we going to do this? And the landlord's arguing with about, how are we going to make this all work? But the truth is, it took us like a few years to get used to the systems. And then they incentivized the restaurants to say, because we won't be sorting your trash, you are, then you'll cut back on your bills.
Mm-hmm.
So they've just done an amazing job of training now a couple of, generations of people how to properly do that in apartment buildings and how to do that in restaurants. And so that, now it's just people just do it. Mm-hmm. And it's like a European country already. You know, like there's just, you, this is where you sort things. I wish we were like that in New York. I don't know where you guys are at in New Orleans, but.
Not.
We're not there yet.
Yeah, no, we're not. Not really in a lot of ways.
But we all need to be all over that because that's like a one really easy way to cut back, you know, the gas emissions in landfill is just separating the trash.
Absolutely. That's a great point. It reminds me, Elizabeth, of when seatbelt laws became mandatory. Think about how much everybody griped about having to wear a seatbelt. And then now it's like, I don't, could never even consider not wearing a seatbelt, right? Right.
So, or you're in a state where people don't wear helmets and you're like, is that a thing?
Yeah, right, exactly. Just common sense, a little bit of getting used to something, friends, and things like that. And taking just, I think, a few simple steps to really even just kind of think about it like we're talking about, right? Just common sense and think about waste and think about where the stuff's going, where it came from, how you can be more respectful of the whole process. Elizabeth, do me a favor. Tell people one more time where they can find you online and all that good stuff.
I have a website. It's elizabethfaulkner.com, and my last name is spelled F-A-L-K-N-E-R without the U. And then I'm also on Instagram all the time, posting all kinds of food facts and food waste ideas and everything else, whatever I'm eating.
right on.
And Twitter at Chef Faulkner. And then I have a Facebook fan page. And most of my Instagram feed goes to that, too, and it's Chef Elizabeth Faulkner.
Okay, awesome. And also, I wanted to mention really quickly, too, Women Chefs and Restaurateurs.
Yes, thanks.
Sure.
I've been involved with Women Chefs and Restaurateurs, or WCR, since the beginning for like 26 years now. And I was the president 5 years ago, and I am currently the president of the board of directors. That's an interesting organization because we have seen so much change lately and focus on women chefs in this business. Thank goodness, because we've all been marching along, making all kinds of great food all along anyway. And we're at womenchefs.org online if you want to look at that. We have a big fun event coming up celebrating Joyce Goldstein, a pioneering chef in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And our event's in San Francisco November 4th.
Okay.
And it's fun. We're really the voice of women in the industry.
It's very cool. I was checking out the website, and it's a great organization, friends, so go check that out. What we'll do, Elizabeth, sometime is hopefully we can get you back on the show, and we'll talk about that.
That sounds great.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much for making time. It was a pleasure chatting with you today.
I had so much fun.
Thank you.
Love talking about food.
So we'll get you back on. We'll do it again.
Okay.
Friends, we're going to take a little break here, and I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week, friends. I do appreciate it. As always, hope you enjoyed that conversation with Chef Elizabeth Faulkner. Interesting topic, interesting stuff there. Reducing food waste. I think it was very enlightening to talk about not only the obvious sort of economic waste, if you will, of food waste, but how systematically we waste food and how that affects the carbon footprint, global warming, and that sort of thing. So there you go. Take home message, I think, is just little by little, do some sensible stuff. It's not too hard to reduce your food waste fairly significantly, whether we're talking about in your home or if we're talking about in a restaurant. But friends, this is our parting shot for the week, and it has nothing to do with food waste. I was reading a post recently on Facebook. I'm a member of different groups that relate to different beverages, right? And this one in particular was for bourbon and whiskey and scotch. And we've talked about this on the show before, but what happens in a lot of these groups, and especially in sort of the whiskey bourbon ones, we get the bourbon bros in there that kind of go all bourbon hero on us, like to belittle people. People come in looking for guidance saying, hey, is this a good one? And then people rip on them, all that kind of stuff. So just sort of framing the conversation here. There's a lot of that goes on. Now, most of the people in these groups don't like that behavior and they're not like that, but there's enough of it that goes on there. And I find a preponderance of those when we talk about bourbon bros. But in this particular post, and I wish I had saved it, I didn't, just because I would read it to you directly if I did. But overall, the idea was this particular guy, a bourbon bro, went into a bar and ordered a dram of something, right? That's how he ordered his drink. I'd like a dram of this bourbon. And the bartender didn't know what the term meant. And so then this bourbon bro goes on and on and on about how stupid the bartender was. And if you're going to be a whiskey bar, how do you not know what a dram is and how lame and how stupid, blah, blah, blah. Then another dude shoots back and says, well, why are you drinking a dram anyway? Who would order a dram? A dram is a small amount of whiskey. So we had this sort of bourbon bro pissing contest going on. I thought the post was kind of funny, but it did, you know, made me ask the question, what exactly is a dram? Now, just to be clear for the record overall, and in an effort to try and be complete, it doesn't stand for Does Real Ass Music, and it doesn't stand for the abbreviation of DRAMS, which is short, or the abbreviation DRAMS, which is short for drama. So, for example, I'm not interested in her DRAMS, meaning I don't really care about her drama. Okay, I learned both of those from the Urban Dictionary. I didn't know either one of those, Does Real Ass Music or DRAMS being short for drama. But I wanted to put that out there. We're putting those ones aside. Now, as far as I know, it's fairly synonymous with whiskey. And certainly, I mean, I just know it as being synonymous with booze. And it refers to being like a pour, a nip, a shy top, always one of my favorites, a splash. Another thing I saw on Urban Dictionary, which I thought was kind of cool, they refer to the DRAM as, quote, the amount is determined by the generosity of the pourer. So I thought that was pretty cool. But what does that exactly mean? You know, what is a DRAM then? Is it just a pour of something? There's also, you know, of course, things out there like allspice DRAM, the Caribbean liqueur that adds that special note to so many tiki drinks, one of my favorite things out there. And I've always known it to also mean something, you know, away from alcohol or liquid, sort of like having a DRAM of caring, you know, having a dash or a bit of something, compassion, that sort of thing. Now, what is a DRAM then? We'll get to that question. Historically, it's a unit of volume and a unit of mass, and it still is, and it also was a coin. So let's take the coin one first. It was a silver coin that was minted by the Armenian Kingdom of Cilicia between 1199 and 1375. And the name of that coin is actually derived from the Greek drachma, which was, of course, a very common coin, and actually the Greek currency until it was replaced by the euro. And I believe that the Romans used the drachma for a period of time as well. And back then there was, because of how coins were valued, the coin actually related to a unit of weight as well. But we're not going to go too far down that road. But it is a unit of weight, and it is one today. In the apothecary weight system, okay, it is an eighth of an ounce, or 60 grains of something. The apothecary weight system. In the U.S. customary system, it is a 16th of an ounce of something. Not an eighth, a 16th of an ounce, which would be 27.34 grams, or grains, excuse me, or 1.77 grams. Now, anybody who says that we shouldn't use the metric system is pretty frickin' stupid. 1.77 grams, 16th of an ounce. Okay, yeah, whatever. Also an argument for another time. So you with me? Apothecary weight system, eighth of an ounce, because I'm an American, so I'm sticking with that system. Or the U.S. customary system, a 16th of an ounce. Still confused? Yeah, me too, sort of. But okay, there you go. There's a DRAM as it relates to a unit of weight. It is a unit of volume, a recognized one. And I guess that's what we're largely concerned with here, the stuff of drink. In volume, it is an eighth of a fluid ounce. Now, a little side note here that I thought was kind of interesting. I was reading a particular Scotch website, and they were talking, they get into how do you, using a speed pour, if somebody orders a DRAM, what's the count when you pour, meaning how much do you count? Now, the standard, and there are some arguments here, depends on the pour, depends on how you count, depends on some other factors, angle of the bottle, blah, blah, blah. But kind of, from my understanding, sort of the standard is a 3-second pour out of a speed pourer is 1.5 ounces. Now, some say if you free pour, a 4-count is 1.5 ounces, but again, this all kind of varies. But their whole point was, if you're using a speed pour in a bar and somebody orders a DRAM, what is that? It's a quarter of a second. If you use that 3-second rule there to get 1.5 ounces in a pour. Not sure how you account for a quarter of a second of a pour, but there you go. So maybe that gets back to the second guy who responded to the post. His point is, you know, why would you even order a DRAM? Who would order an eighth of an ounce? You're going to want a pour of something. And how could you even pour a DRAM? Well, actually, you know, I worked in the wine industry for a long time. When you're tasting, you're giving a pretty small pour. An eighth of an ounce, that's pretty small. I generally like to, even with spirits, like to get two sips of something. So an eighth of an ounce, probably a little small, probably a quarter of an ounce is a better way to go. But there you go. So that's a DRAM, an eighth of an ounce, or a quarter of a second pour out of a speed pourer, if you're keeping score. Still with me? So I'm still confused what these guys were arguing about, because it's the DRAM, I think, is a term that's not meant to be taken literally all the time. You know, again, it's a pour, a nip, a shy top, a splash of something. It's kind of become that term. But I guess if you want to be technical and tear down the bourbon bro who needed to be torn down because he was being a bourbon bro in the first place, ripping on the bar, who didn't know what a DRAM was, then I guess you're going to get technical and let him know what a DRAM was, that it's an eighth of an ounce, even though the dude didn't actually say that. Still trying to unpack what happened in this whiskey bar kerfuffle on the Facebook post there in that group. But I'll just simply say this to those two guys. How about just have a dram of chill and don't be such a dram, or maybe I should say damn jerk or bourbon bro. That's our parting shot. Here's to you.